So we need a new model of how we build community. But we need community. Humans need community. The internet has not made community obsolete. It maybe has changed the way we do community, but we need community, and we need to nurture and cultivate our souls. Those two things right there are the religious impulse. The question is, what institutional form does it take? And Howard Thurman reminded us 100 years ago. He said, mystics and institutional religion do not get along. What was true 100 years ago, I think this is why Jesus was crucified. I think we see this again and again and again, that the mystics are always the outsiders. Back to your comment, they are maybe right on the edge on the inside, but they also can step to be just on the outside. And sometimes they get crucified, sometimes they get burned at the stake, sometimes they get swallowed in and made doctors of the church. I mean, there's these different things. But the reality is, I agree with Howard Thurman that the mystical impulse and the institutional impulse will always be somewhat at odds. And the question is, again, not to turn that into another dualism where mysticism is good, but to recognize that mysticism will be essential to reforming the institution. And that's the point I think Thurman is trying to make, and the point that I think all of us have to take to heart, and that those of us who are confident that we've been called into a contemplative spirituality, even if we want nothing to do with the institution, and I understand that, but to try to recognize that we have to embody our spirituality in service of community, and whether that's institutional religion or whether that's some other venue or context in which that happens, I think that's going to vary from person to person, but that's the work that has to be done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast today. I'm joined by a spiritual director, teacher, retreat leader, and author, Carl McCallman. Carl McCallman is a layperson under formal spiritual guidance by sisters and monks, affiliated with the Trappist Monastery of the Holy Spirit Conyers, Georgia. He received formation in the practice of Christian spirituality and contemplative leadership through the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation and learned the art of spiritual direction through the Institute of Pastoral Studies. For a number of years, as an adult, he studied cultic, goddess, and nature-centered spirituality, and some of his older books are written from that perspective. His early studies spurred in him great respect for interfaith dialogue, but also left him thirsty for the profound wisdom of the Christian mystics contemplatives, whom he had followed ever since reading Evelyn Underhill's Mysticism while in college. His newer books all reflect his love for contemplative, monastic, and mystical Christianity. In addition to having authored more than a dozen books, McCallman contributes to Patios, Huffington Post, and Avi of the Arts, and travels widely to speak and lead retreats. His work is characterized by an optimistic, expansive understanding of spirituality, rooted in Christianity while embracing the wisdom of the world's contemplative traditions. He feels most at home among those Christians, pagans, and seekers of other paths who recognize that honoring different religions can be a way of enriching your own. So we had a marvelous sitting at a table with Carl, speaking about many of the topics just mentioned: goddess spirituality, the integration of the divine feminine, duality, non-duality, awe, wonder, imagination in the context of scriptural study and living life, the sacredness of nature. What else? What not? So you are all invited to join us in the conversation. This is the Free Radical Podcast, and to support it, please feel free to subscribe to the channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel inspired and nourished by the conversation, you can like it, you can share it, and you can drop your comments to keep the conversation ongoing. So without further ado, dear friends, here's Carl McCallman. Hey, welcome, Carl. Thank you so much for joining us in the Free Radical Podcast.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Swami.
Pleasure. Thanks for accepting the invitation. And generally, I like to begin asking my guests, what do the term free radical invoke in them? For me, it's about radical going to the root of things and doing it in a way that invokes freedom. So free radical, like free exploration of the foundations of reality. But you please tell me.
Sure. And I mean, I know there is a chemical meaning of the word free radical, but that's not necessarily my long suit. So I just, of course, approach it more poetically or mystically, if you will. Mm. And I would argue that, you know, all spirituality, all contemplative and mystical spirituality invites us into the root. It invites us into the root of consciousness. It invites us into the root of embodiment. It invites us into the root of what it means to be alive, to be human. And as far as the free, okay, so I come primarily, not exclusively, but primarily out of the Christian tradition. And there's a teaching within Christianity that the truth sets you free. So that to me, you know, one of the hallmarks of any authentic spirituality or mysticism is that it is liberating. It is liberative and liberating. So, you know, it's one of the things we can do is look at our lives, you know, the trajectory of our lives, and are we moving toward greater freedom? And that is can be a sign that we are really being faithful in our spiritual walk. So so that I think it's a beautiful connection, you know, the rootedness and freedom is almost like wings. So your feet are on the ground, but you're soaring. And so it's a lovely image for your podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. And regarding what you mentioned, that I appreciate the chemical connection to the term, that actually I referred to it in my second book called Radical Personalism. And in chemistry, a free radical constitutes like a unit that somehow attacks important macromolecules and leads to some form of disruption. And somehow I also like the term free radical in the sense of not only what we just shared, exploring roots and freedom, but also creating some necessary disruption, right? Like some holy disturbance, if you will, which many times all mystical traditions, as you say, invite us. When you go to the root, when you do some descent work, not just transcending and ascending, but descending, you will have to be disturbed in a healthy way, right? In a necessary way to be confronted and see and deal with what may have been in the shed of our subconscious mind for some time, right?
Yeah. I live near Atlanta, and of course, the home of the late, great John Lewis, who used to talk about, you know, political activism as being getting into good trouble. That was his phrase, good trouble. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're reminding me of that just now. And I think that, yeah, the mystical life is a life of good trouble. I was on a podcast recently talking about the Bible, and the host asked me if I thought the Bible was a dangerous book. And I said, well, I hope it is. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then I talked about how the Bible's been misused. But I think if we are faithful to the wisdom at the root, at the heart of it, it is dangerous because it will set us free from our illusions. It will set us free from systems of power and control in our society. And that's what I think all great wisdom teachings, not just the Bible, of course, but all great wisdom teachings promise to do that for us. So.
Thank you. And I appreciate the nuance in the term dangerous. Yes, sacred book is dangerous. It can be dangerous in the undesirable way, so to say, and you can weaponize revelation, who knows for what, and justify the unjustifiable. And it can be dangerous in the necessary way that needs to be dangerous. So good trouble, as you say. Good trouble versus bad trouble. Yeah. So, Carl, reading your biography, I was kind of struck by the like arc of your journey, and you spent some years studying cultic spirituality, goddess traditions, nature-centered path, and eventually found yourself drawn more deeply into contemplative Christianity and monastic wisdom. So I'm curious about that trajectory, that movement in your life, right? Was that transition more of a shift or more of a deepening that somehow ended up encompassing each one of these layers or chapters of your journey?
Sure. And I would say the answer is yes. I think my journey has been marked by times of disruption, times of, you know, kind of paradigm shift, if you will. But looking back, especially, you know, seeing kind of the golden thread, seeing the common energy that guided me all the way through. You know, I was raised, you know, I'm an American of European ancestry. So I was raised in the United States in the 1960s, 1970s. So the period after the Second World War. And it was a period when Protestant Christianity was still dominant. I became involved in charismatic Christianity, which is a very experiential process of, you know, encountering the sacred through speaking in tongues and through, you know, having visionary experiences and those kinds of things. So, but I also had my own very deep kind of, you know, spiritual awakening when I was about 16 years old, and really didn't know what to do with it, and eventually bumped into the shadow side of the Christian religion, a cultural Christianity in America, where there is, maybe it's very patriarchal, it's very homophobic, there's a lot of systems of control, very dualistic, you know, kind of the sheep and the goats dualism, that kind of thing. And fortunately, I had a wonderful friend who gave me Evelyn Underhill's book on mysticism, which was published in 1911. So it was an older book, but it really just opened
it here. I have it here with me. I'm about
there
to
read
it.
There you go. Yeah. I don't know where my
copy is. Sure, you
is.
Have it close to you. It's a necessary close companion. There we
you
are.
Know, so there, yeah, you know, what you know, heart of my heart, what an important book that has been. So I would say that book was my initiation into kind of a conscious commitment to walk a mystical path. And to Underhill's credit, I mean, she was a member of the Church of England. So again, coming out of that kind of Protestant Christian matrix, but she loved Rumi, you know, she loved Tagore. She loved many great poets and writers from around the world. So, you know, kind of like what I was saying about myself, you know, grounded in, but not exclusively a Christian. And really gave me permission to recognize that that the spiritual life is meant to transform us from the inside out, and it is meant to give us you know, access to wisdom from all over the world. And of course, coming of age in the late 70s, early 80s, I was exposed to Yogananda, I was exposed to Carlos Castaneda, to Alan Watts, you know, a number of these different writers who, you know, for a middle-class white Southern American, you know, gave me that initial access, you know, and then Ram Dass, and, you know, and it's just, from then it was just off to the races. So I've always had kind of one foot in the Christian world and then one foot in a real interest in, you know, seeing what the wisdom of the world has to offer. As far as, you know, the Celtic, you know, the pagan, Celtic, Wiccan, goddess, that whole world. Partially, it's my own ancestry. McCormick is a Scottish name. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and my nickname is Sky, which comes from the island in Scotland. So people call me Sky too. But my family, my great-grandfather was from Scotland. So I have that deep interest in you know, the Celtic tradition. It kind of is in my DNA. It's in my bloodstream. And then the other thing, I think, you know, Christianity, especially in the 70s, I think it's gotten a lot better in the last 50 years. But when I was a child, Christianity was very patriarchal. You know, God was only referred to as God the Father, that kind of thing. And so I knew from an early age, you know, I'm a non-binary person. My gender is very expansive. And I needed a feminine face to God. And back then, the only place you could really find that, at least for me, my experience, was in the more pagan, earth-centered spiritualities. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe if I'd been exposed, you know, to Hinduism or to the, you know, to some of the bodhisattvas in the Dharma, I would have had a richer understanding. But I have to begin where I was, you know, and in that Christian world, that very patriarchal world. Mm. So I became very much interested in the goddess tradition. Obviously, not only the Western goddess tradition, which is Wicca, but through that, learning about the divine feminine, you know, really from throughout the world. Mm. So that became a very important part of my journey. And I think, you know, I returned to Christianity mainly because I just wanted to go deeper in the Christian tradition. And I live close to a Trappist monastery. I wanted to study with the Trappist monks. Mm-hmm. And then I began to do some work with the Jesuits. So I moved to a more Catholic expression. And again, the Catholic situation has, there's a lot of shadow energy there. There's a lot of problems in the Catholic world. But there is an appreciation of the mystical that was very, very, you know, nurturing for me. And through that, then I met figures like Ramon Panikkar or Bede Griffiths or Abhishektananda. I'm sure you're familiar with some of these figures who rooted in the Christian tradition, but truly are bigger than any one religion, you know. And in many ways, I would say, and Merton falls into that category as
That's
well.
That's what I was thinking. When you say Trappist, it was Thomas Merton for sure.
Yeah, you know, and Thomas Keating for a more recent figure. So those people continue to be, you know, very important teachers for me. And so at this point, I would say, you know, I'm really, I think of myself as, yes, I'm a follower of Jesus, but I'm also a follower of Buddha. Several years ago, I did receive precepts in a sangha. So I do identify as a Buddhist as well as a Christian. And so it's really just this kind of desire to be, you know, a citizen of the world, you know, and a citizen of the world's great mystical and wisdom traditions. Now, I still love Christianity. I still work with a lot of Christians. And I have respect for people, really of any faith tradition, who their call is to be, you know, anchored in one tradition. So I don't criticize that, except to the extent that it is then weaponized, like only Christians are going to heaven, or Christians are accepted by God. That I think that's just simply an error. But to be rooted in one tradition, I think can be a very beautiful way to go deep in one's own path. So I like to say I'm comfortable being on campus, you know, in that world that is exclusively Christian, but I'm also comfortable being off campus and being, you know, being in that radical conversation with wisdom wherever it can be found. So
thank you. Thank you, Carl. Sounds like an epic journey that, of course, has not stopped. It's unfolding, ever evolving, ever unfolding.
Yes.
Journeys.
Yes.
And I was thinking about an expression that a friend of mine, a mentor, you may know of him, Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr.
Of course.
This expression of living on the edge of the inside, in terms of being part of a tradition, but you are living on the edge, on the inside. You are, you know, you identify in this case as a Christian in your case, but you are close to the edge, so you remain influenced and nourished by what's going on outside of the circle, and you are not too much of an insider that you can, you are not aware of what's taking place on the other side of the walls, quote unquote, to follow the idea. And I personally totally identify with that in my own journey, in my own tradition called Gaudiya Vaishnavism. I have explored, I identify as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, but also I've been so much enriched by mystical Christianity and Sufism and other schools that somehow I never consider that I left my tradition, but I've been nourished by all of these schools, and I've been able to rediscover my own tradition by the grace of sister traditions, as I like to call them.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I don't even to say other traditions, but sister traditions, right? We are all one family, basically, right?
That's beautiful, yes. And I think that that, you know, that this is in many ways one of the core practices of our time is, you know, because we all start somewhere, you know, even if our family was secular, we start secular. That's our root, and back to radical, that's our root. And so the practice is to be appreciative and faithful towards one's root, even if you are critical of its limitations.
Yeah.
Because I do believe every tradition has its own shadow. But to be appreciative of that, but then also to find what is the appropriate way for you to drink from the other wells. And again, that varies from person to person. It's a very personal journey. But I think, you know, when we think about the tragedy of September 2001, 9/11, and I heard Cynthia Bourgeau speak just a few years after that. And she said, you know, contemplation is our best hope to keep from flying planes into buildings. And I think that was such, you know, a concise, and that may not be word for word, but that was the gist of what she said. And it was so helpful for me. You know, in the words of Rick Doblin, mysticism is the antidote to fundamentalism. And I think that is so true, and something that those of us who feel called to a more contemplative spirituality, that we have to continue to be engaged with our brothers and sisters, our siblings, who maybe are still caught in the illusion of the superiority of their one path. Because the problem with that illusion is that sooner or later it does lead to aggression, if not violence. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and 9/11 is an extreme example of that. Yeah. But then you can also look, you can look at the conflicts in the Middle East, you can look at the conflicts in Northern Ireland, the hostility between Europeans and Native Americans. I mean, it shows up in different forms. The wars in Europe over the Protestant Reformation. Incredible, incredible violence. And so that here we are trying to drink from the well of infinite compassion. And yet we see social systems evolving or manifesting that become very aggressive. And so it's a terrible paradox, a terrible wound that I think all of us have to work together to, you know, to bring healing. And so
On many levels, also, Carl, to be the peace we want to see in the world, right? Like in the world and in the war, regarding to war, be the peace you want to see there. And as you quote Cynthia Bourgeau, like in our tradition, we will say all these conflicts and wars are symptoms of the actual problem. And the only problem is the ignorance. Like Jesus will say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. The ignorance that blinds us to our brotherhood and sisterhood and fellowship. So we start to develop this dualistic framework, right? Fragmented framework. And when we divide where it's us and them rather than only us, all of us are us, we start to see in binaries, and then conflict, division, separateness come, and the war begins at home, so to say, and then it takes its macrocosmic expressions, but all begin in the microcosmic divided mind of the individual. So I totally agree with it. And I'm thinking regarding this idea of brotherhood and sisterhood, and in our tradition we'll say Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, there's only one family. And there's no more than one family, actually. When we think in terms of two families, we start to become fundamentalist and sectarian. So it's we're all friends. And in that connection, I'm thinking your website is called Anamchara, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which in Celtic wisdom refers to a soul friend, right?
Exactly, exactly.
It's interesting because yesterday, the day before we are recording this episode, a soul friend, an Anamchara of mine, I did a podcast with her in Spanish, and shared with me after the podcast, and she didn't have any idea about me talking to you and anything. She just shares a flyer, a picture of a book with that title, Anamchara, famous book by John O'Donohue.
John O'Donohue. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
And she didn't know that I was already familiar with Celtic wisdom and that I was going to have a conversation with someone who's website is called Anamchara, so it was quite synchronistic. So anyhow, Anamchara refers to a soul friend, right? So I don't know, in my opinion, it feels like someone who, soul friend, who sees you for who you are unconditionally beyond your masks, is not turning away despite whatever comes. And the soul friend is also willing to be seen, to take the same risk of being seen in one's nakedness. So I'm curious what drew you to that concept. How does it shape the way you understand spiritual friendship?
Yeah, well, there is a ministry that comes out of the Christian tradition, although again, it is bigger than any one religion, a ministry known as spiritual direction or spiritual companionship. And I'll tell you the way I was taught to pronounce it, the H is silent, so Anamkara. Anamkara. It's kind of like Celtic or Celtic, and I like to say Celtic.
I had that problem for some time. It was Celtic. No, it's Celtic. But why?
Celtics are a basketball team. And
Okay.
Celtic is an ethnic heritage.
Yeah.
So that's the easy way to
Thank you.
differentiate. So the H is silent. So Anamkara. In fact, if you look at John O'Donohue's book, the H is actually absent, and there's a diacritical mark above the C
I
that
see.
represents the H. So again,
I see.
Anamkara, and that's the Irish spelling, and with the H is the Scots Gaelic spelling, but it's the same word. But so I had a mystical awakening when I was 16 years old, and I mentioned that earlier, and then I had the friend give me Evelyn Underhill's book, and so for several years, it was really just a study. I was reading anything I get my hands on, really not just, going very deep because I didn't have any guidance. And when I was in graduate school, I discovered a ministry in Washington, D.C. I was in graduate school in Northern Virginia, in Washington, D.C., called the Shalem Institute. And Shalem was founded by an Episcopal priest who had studied with Tibetan Buddhists. So again, it had that interspiritual kind of, ecumenical quality. But the and the story is, so Tilden Edwards was this priest, and he was studying with a tulku in California, and the experience was so meaningful, he was ready to resign his priesthood and become a student of the Dharma. And the tulku would not accept him as a student. The tulku said, you are not my student, you are my brother priest. And what I would ask you to do, instead of moving out here and studying with me, is to return to your church, return to your ministry, but dig deep into the Christian tradition. Because anything that the Dharma can give you, the mystical tradition within Christianity can give you. It was wonderful advice.
Yeah,
And
it
so,
reminds me, sorry, Kyle, it reminds me Thomas Merton. Once he had
yes.
correspondence with a practitioner, with different people, but one of them was Mahanam
Dhamma.
Brahmachari from actually from my tradition, and he
Yes, yes.
recommended that to Thomas Merton. Please go back to the roots of mystical Christianity and
And
rediscover all.
Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama are two voices that continue to do that. So it's so Tilden went back to Washington, D.C. and raised some money and found some other people who were doing this kind of work and started the Shalem Institute. So 10 years later, I'm a graduate student. I plug in with them. And one of the things that Shalem does is it has a ministry of the spiritual companionship. Now, it's interesting. A lot of people will ask, well, is that a guru? And I say, well, the theology is a little different. That in the Christian tradition, the theology is that the spirit is your guru, the spirit is your enlightener, and so the spiritual director is really more like a midwife, more like a companion
And I
who
will say I
walks.
understand the word guru very much in that same way, though I understand some other people may read it differently, but I appreciate you brought the Socratic idea of teacher as a midwife, basically.
Yes. And I think, and again, that may be, again, a Christian misunderstanding, but this idea that I think I wouldn't be able to do this work because I don't have any sense of myself as being enlightened. I see myself as somebody on the path of enlightenment. Hopefully we all are. And so when I work with somebody, and you're right, it's very Socratic. It's about asking questions, it's about deep listening, it's about looking for the evidence of the spirit at work in their hearts and their lives. And so trusting that that work is already happening with or without the companion. But what the companion does is they provide the mirror. They hold the space and provide the mirror. And then through the judicious use of the Socratic method of asking questions and listening deeply, people, and I've seen it happen where it's like, the spirit is here. They have that moment of recognition. And whether you want to call that, being born again or being enlightened or Satori or, there's many different ways we describe that around the world. But it's beautiful when it happens. And then to continue to walk with them, because enlightenment really is a process. I think it was Shinryu Suzuki who used to say, to meditate is to be enlightened. You may spend 40 or 50 or 60 years on the cushion. So your enlightenment, for some people it's like that, but for many of us, it's like a flower blossoming.
And I will add to that the blossoming never ends, in one sense, at least from our tradition perspective. It's not that there is a dead end to enlightenment, right? Like now and on the other side, there's nothing else to discover, to love, to deepen, but it's an eternal, ever-evolving
process. Yeah, it's just like the universe. I think it was Ken Wilber who said, maybe we shouldn't speak of the Big Bang, we should speak of the Big Bloom. Mm. But if that's the case, the flower is still blossoming. And you and I are in the midst of the bloom. And so, yes, of course, our own individual enlightenment journey will be eternal. This is the way in which our, you know, our enlightenment journey is in resonance with the larger human family. Mm-hmm. That, you know, for one of us to be enlightened, we all are enlightened. And that's the really the bodhisattva, you know, the commitment of the bodhisattva, that, you know, that my enlightenment requires your enlightenment. And so I live in service to you. And so, you know, it's interesting how you see these amazing teachings and certain traditions, you know, like the word bodhisattva, you know, and we all think of Mahayana Buddhism, but of course there are echoes of it in other traditions.
I'm thinking about my particular tradition, and there's many statements of great personalities, like, for example, praying, God, give me the karma of all living entities, and I stay here paying and free all of them, please. Like this type of universal compassion, like I'm willing to be here for them in every way possible, and things like that. And I was thinking also drawing parallels. I cannot avoid doing that, of course.
It's great.
Yeah, no. Very beautiful, redeeming exercise of deepening communion. But when you speak about, okay, in the Christian perspective, the spirit will be seen as the guru, so to say, and the teacher, and the spiritual director is more of a facilitator or witness and to that experience. And in our tradition, we'll say something quite similar. Like actually, God in the heart is the original guru, so to say, the original guides, and the individual human gurus or guides are like mirrors of potential. I like to use the word mirror, right?
So, the language is almost identical, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, a mirror of potential. Great. Someone that comes to your life showing all that you can be. Embodying that and accompanying you through empathic listening. Okay, not so much telling you what to do, but trying to listen together what the divine wants to share and how to embrace that. So,
you know, this radical gesture of trust. You know, trusting that the divine, the spirit is at work in every one of our hearts. I mean, even people who we see their lives are lost to violence or addiction or you know, terrible suffering, causing suffering, that the spirit has not given up on that person, and that the spirit is doing what she can to bring, hopefully, you know, positive transformation, hopefully sooner than later, but we're all on our own journey. And so it liberates us. We don't have to fix anybody. We don't have to save anybody, but we do have to love people, and we do have to be compassionate, and we do have to be kind. And sometimes that means setting boundaries too. Be realistic about that. But the mystical path is this path of just incredible love. Thomas Merton talks about standing on the street corner just falling in love with everybody.
It's epiphany, yeah.
You know?
It's great.
Yes, you know. And so it's just, you know, to have that recognition that's what's being asked of us is just radical love. And then trusting that how that plays out, that the spirit is there to guide us and to lead us on that journey. So,
yeah. Thank you. Which sometimes it could be more challenging and difficult trying to love everyone than just trying to convert everyone or tell people what to do or transform them. That's such a great temptation that comes from. Yeah.
Well, yeah, sorry. Merton himself said most Christians live on the level of law because they find the demands of charity to be too difficult.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating teaching.
Amen to and, that. Yeah.
You know, and not that there isn't a place for boundaries and agreements, because that's, I mean, it's like the skeleton, you know, the skeleton is the boundary and agreements of the body. Every community needs some sort of boundaries and agreements. So it's not that law is bad, but the problem is, I mean, this Jesus taught this law without spirit kills, you know, And so to always, you know, and what is the spirit? The spirit is love. And so
yeah, the ultimate law is love, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Love is
Our
the law.
Tradition
exactly.
will say there are many rules and regulations and laws, but all of them should be, the essence of that is basically fall in love with the divine. So all endless rules and regulations in every scripture are servants of that ultimate law. So if they serve you that ultimate law, you follow them. If you need to break them to follow the ultimate law, sometimes we need to break the rule after following it properly, then you will know when to break them and so on and so forth.
St. Augustine said, love and do as you will, mm-hmm. which sounds antinomian.
Mm.
But if you are truly doing that first bit, you're truly embodied in love, anchored in love, given to love, and seeking to follow love, then your will becomes one with the divine will anyways.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, he gives us in what? Love and do what you will. Six words. He gives us the summation of all law.
Yeah. We have to stay with the first word enough, right? Love.
Yeah.
Play out the implications. Play out the implications.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't worry about those others until you.
Yeah.
You know, exactly.
Yeah. It reminds me of the prayer of, I think it's Spanish priest. Like he will say, I don't recall the whole, it was a whole prayer and poem, but like falling in love is the most practical thing of all. Like when you learn to fall in love, everything else you do will be like informed by that falling in love. But again, first you have to fall in love. First you have to love and then do as you will. Carl, we were talking a minute ago about, of course, spiritual friendship, spiritual direction, and how the spirit is the original guru, so to say. And you referred to the spirit as she in feminine terms. So I like to,
yes.
And I totally appreciate that. And I like to go back to the idea of goddess spirituality, because, of course, in many traditions, today, especially, I would say there is some renewed interest in discovering the divine feminine. Like if our collective subconscious is feeling the need of, we need to do something with the feminine. We need to integrate the feminine dimension. We need to acknowledge to properly honor it. Many times, as you said, also sometimes instinctively we have the tendency, especially religious people, to recover the divine feminine as a corrective to overtly patriarchal religious frameworks. The other day, a friend of mine shared a quote, something that says something like, if you only worship the god, but not the goddess, you are halfway toward atheism. So I like
that. That's great. I love it. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you only worship half of the equation, you are actually halfway to atheism. That's half a truth, right? Just the god, not the goddess. And half truths can be sometimes worse than a clear lie, so to say.
This is a whole conversation.
Yeah.
You know, certainly Christianity has, you know, because of it coming up through the Roman Empire and the kind of the hyper patriarchal, you know, imperial militaristic culture that I think we've lost a lot of what would have been innate in Jesus and his followers,
mm-hmm.
you know, the whole tradition of the Shekinah in Jewish mysticism.
Shekinah, Sophia, Holy mm-hmm. Spirit, of course, Mary, whatnot.
And even the Holy Spirit in Aramaic, Jesus's language, or still in Syriac, which is a sister language there, Holy Spirit is feminine. So for me to say to you, we listen to the guidance of the Holy Spirit as she leads us, that is actually theologically correct.
Grammatically correct.
But for many Christians, if they've only been exposed to the more patriarchal expression, it feels almost jarring. And so we have a lot of recovery work to do. And I think if you look at European history, you know, the witch burnings, the kind of the suppression and it was seen as devil worship. I mean, it was like by that point, the goddess had been erased. You know, the hostility towards the witches, they were accused of worshiping the devil. But the reality is that, you know, and I know scholars have different theories here, But about, what, 90 to 95% of the people killed for the crime of witchcraft, the alleged crime of witchcraft, were women. So it was clearly a kind of a holocaust towards the feminine that took place. And that is right on the eve of the Protestant Reformation. And of course, what the Protestant Reformation does is it even strips Mary away. Mm-hmm. You know, Mary becomes relegated. She gets to be Jesus's mom. She shows up at Christmas. You know, she shows up very briefly at Easter. But the idea of Mary as kind of the you know, a mediator of divine grace is just is just silenced. Mm. And so Christianity has become this hyper masculine, hyper patriarchal religion. And I think we see that play out in the hostility that so many Christians have towards non-Christians, you know, or towards queer people, or even towards women. The fact that the Catholic Church to this day refuses to give women ordained leadership is just, you know, it's just evidence of its own, you know, kind of being trapped in the patriarchal mindset. So you're right. I think that the resurgence of the feminine in many, many forms is almost like a healthy corrective, that the spirit will guide us. Sometimes it's over generations, you know, we wish it would be faster. Mm. But I think, you know, especially, and then again, when you go back to 9/11 and, you know, the terrorists flying planes into buildings, their image of their religion, of Islam, is a hyper patriarchal image. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to acknowledge that the enemy here, you know, the enemy is not Islam. The enemy is not Christianity. Mm-hmm. The enemy is that kind of hyper patriarchal, that kind of silencing of the feminine that then has led to maybe violence and aggression that is not consistent with the teachings, you know?
Yeah. And for me, so. the behind that hyper patriarchal approach, which externally takes the shape of violence and so-called strength externally, mm-hmm. again, behind that, there mm-hmm. is so much fear to the unknown that the feminine represents, right? Because the feminine dimension is also so tied to chaos in the positive sense of the word, like the chaos from which creation comes, right? Creative chaos. And you need to go out of your comfort zone to explore the unknown and the potential for creation in that chaos realm, which is all embodied in the feminine. And we, most of us men, are again in the under the mask of being men and strong, are actually terrified of having, well, embracing the courage of exploring that dimension and integrating it and yeah, knowing what to do with it.
Well, then this goes back to your comment earlier that when religions manifest violence, it is an expression of the violence held within the breasts of individual people within that religion.
Yeah.
And so you know, looking at it from a Buddhist perspective and realizing there is so much suffering that is going on in the hearts and minds of so many people who they believe they're doing the right thing. They believe they're being obedient to God, but they're being obedient to God in a narrative that has been given to them that is so stunted and so limited. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of work to be done very much on that individual level, mm-hmm. you know, that, you know, just, and then this is why I admire Carl Jung, you know, and again, he, you know, his father was a Protestant minister. So he comes out of that patriarchal world and he just recognized on a purely psychological level, of course, his psychology goes quite deep, but still a purely psychological level that we all carry the animus and the anima. Mm-hmm. And that part of the movement towards psychological health and towards individuation is finding some way to reconcile that. That obviously will look different for different people, you know. I'm fairly non-binary in my own gender identity, and that does not mean any kind of a repudiation of masculinity and femininity. I think gender is a gift, you know, and for so many people, you know, they're anchored in their assigned gender and their biological gender, and that's beautiful. But even if, you know, even if you're a man's man, you know, or you're a girly girl, we still need to have access to that other dimension within us, Or else there is that risk of our gender identity collapses into a kind of a form of aggression, not only towards ourselves but towards others, you know, or inverted aggression, which is fear. Exactly, you know. And so so it's like we have a lot of work to do on an individual level, even while we also have work to do on a social level.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my own tradition and how there is so much emphasis, like again with any other mystical school, about goddess worship, but also paradoxically on a more institutional level in some communities we have shadow expressions like the one you referred to, the Catholic Church. Like for example, in our tradition, some groups are women cannot be gurus, for example, because being born in a body that is not fit for that, and the role of woman is more like at home and cooking and giving birth to children, and this type of disempowering, outdated pattern, so to say. But interestingly enough, in principle, feminine tradition, the dimension in our tradition is like absolutely central. Even for us, the highest expression of divinity is the love of Radha, we will call, which is the name of the goddess and is the embodiment of devotion itself. And we will have in our scriptures that the male dimension of God, sometimes called Krishna, the male dimension is described as falling onto the feet of the goddess and worshiping the feet of the goddess, as well as trying to deeply understand the heart of the goddess and empathize with the experience of the goddess. So for me, it all speaks a lot about this effort that we need also to do to empathize with the feminine dimension, to connect with this, as you say, to integration, right? To integrate wholeness, as Carl Jung will say, right? I'm not so much interested in transcendence, but in wholeness, which for me sounds way more, includes transcendence, but it's not something utterly transcendent, but it integrates all the dimensions.
And let me speak, obviously I'm not, you know, I only have the tiniest knowledge about your own tradition, but I think, you know, that kind of patriarchal suppression of women is global. You see it everywhere. Yeah, you see it in Judaism. You see it in Islam. Mm-hmm. You see it in Buddhism. I mean, it's amazing. I've done a little bit of research into feminist writers on Buddhism, and it blows my mind. Even in mystical Christianity, and mysticism within Christianity has been where women have had the strongest voice historically. Mm. But even there is so much, you know, so much fear of the feminine that has, you know, kind of, again, been the shadow. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I think we are very blessed to live at a time in history where, you know, if you think about like the rise of agriculture, when we moved from horticulture to agriculture, from the hoe to the plow, a pregnant woman working a plow, she would lose her baby, you know? And so it became almost a kind of a socially expedient for women to stay within the home and men to work in the fields. But then that just kept replicating itself. And then with the rise of empire, the soldiers needed to be strong, you know, burly men to go out and fight the battles and defend the land and so forth. And unfortunately to be, you know, wars of aggression as well. And so it's just, we're at the end of a, basically a 5,000 year experiment that has run its course. And so I think we, you know, as we've moved beyond, you know, we're moving into the information age, we're moving into the, you know, I mean, when I think about artificial intelligence and, you know, we have no idea, you know, I think artificial intelligence is to us what the printing press was to Gutenberg, you know, and that, you know, that there will be, and I know a lot of people are either afraid of artificial intelligence or they disapprove of it. But the genie is out of the bottle. It's here. And I think those of us who are conscious, the question is not, is artificial intelligence good or bad? The question is, how do we shape our usage of artificial intelligence in service of humanity? You know, I wrote an article on my Substack just last week or recently about people creating scams using artificial intelligence. So we already see how it is used to harm. Mm. The question now becomes, for those of us who are seeking, you know, are on the path to enlightenment, how do we use these new technologies in service? That's the important question. But, you know, back to the point of gender, in a world where, you know, manual labor is increasingly being automated, the old dynamic of the stronger male body and the more the more tender female body is simply no longer necessary. And now we can, you know, we can all relate on that level of soul development, that level of intellectual skill, that level of compassion and care and wisdom and intuition, where we realize, you know, the genders, the division between the genders is just no longer necessary. Unfortunately, religious groups sometimes are slow in the uptake. You know, so again, not to necessarily to say, oh, the Catholic Church is horrible. I do think the Catholic Church needs to ordain women, and I hope by divine grace it will do it sooner rather than later. And I believe eventually it will. But unfortunately, religious organizations often are very conservative. They're in the business of conserving, and sometimes what they are conserving doesn't need to be conserved. So there's that work we have to
Organize. Like the role, the complementary role between the prophet and the priest, so to say, right? The priest keeping the statu quo, which I understand order, but going back to free radical in chemistry, some sacred disruption of the order, like a prophet may bring to keep the whole thing dynamic and living. And I appreciate your point on AI and technology. I was thinking about and how many of the works are less requiring, so to say, physical strength and inviting us to relate more on a deeper level to each other. And I remember one quote by Nikola Tesla, who is well known by being a father in many ways of technology in so many ways, and his intention in all his inventions was actually, may all this free humanity and give humanity more and more time so they can cultivate their spirit deeply. So somehow I'm thinking, okay, maybe all this technological revolution, though the creators may not have that transcendent intention, I don't know, but if we learn, as you say, how to use it properly, may that free us to see each other to begin with more equally and to relate each other more equally and so on and so forth. So there's place for that. That's the actual question, how to implement that.
You know, one of the things that we've seen here in the United States is when new technologies emerge, that they sometimes get used in the service of pornography. I'm thinking of like the video cassette or the DVD, you know, those kinds of things. And early DVDs, there was a big embrace by the pornography industry, which, you know, when I see pornography, I see suffering and I see women who've been oppressed. And, you know, so there's a lot of tragedy there, even though I do believe sexuality is beautiful and there's nothing wrong with eroticism in art. But pornography is different. Pornography is about control and oppression. So it's fascinating that people with a very low level of consciousness were sometimes the early adopters of these new technology. And I think what the parallel here with AI is the people that are just using AI to make money, you know, maybe that's more elevated than pornography, but it's still relatively low on the spectrum of consciousness, you know? And so, you know, what we have to do is remember that there's more than just these low levels of consciousness, that spirit has given us a full spectrum, and that these tools, when they are utilized for service, when they are utilized for compassion, then we have no idea how we will be freed to, again, to move towards an enlightened society. So, but there's a lot of work to be done, obviously, you know, and, you know, it's important for us to be as conscious and clear about that as possible.
And I appreciate that you use so many times the word service, because it's such a crucial word also for me and our tradition. And at the end of the day, it's not about rejecting stuff or labeling things are good or bad, but the actual ongoing question is, how can this be engaged in service? How can this facilitate me becoming a better servant of everything? So, I'm thinking, Carl, we talked a minute ago about goddess spirituality and another theme in connection to your journey that we briefly mentioned in the introduction is your engagement with nature-centered spirituality, which for me is very feminine side. I mean, nature in itself, right? So in the times we are living, many people feel that the ecological crisis we face is, again, not only technological or political, but it's also spiritual. No? Many traditions in time having made God to otherworldly, too transcendent, too much outside of this world instead of sacredly immanent. So from the perspective of my tradition, I will say we are panentheistic. So the material, material world is not merely inert matter, but the sacred energy, dynamic expression of the divine. We even consider matter as a devotee of God or of the goddess that allows us to offer ourselves through matter. Like, okay, matter is already serving God. I may not be serving God, so by the grace of matter, I can engage myself through matter in connecting to the divine, matter as mother. So yeah, I wonder what did your ears in nature center spirituality teach you about the sacredness of the natural world?
The you know, and again, I think we have to go back to moving into a more non-dual level of consciousness. And I think, you know, we talked about gender. Again, the problem with gender is when we are too dualistic about it. And I think it's the same thing. You know, the problem with, you know, with religion, when religion is dualistic, we're going to heaven, but everybody else isn't, you know, that's a dualistic way of thinking. The same thing with matter and spirit. I think, you know, the relationship between matter and spirit is a spectrum and not a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And that we already know just in the material world, just the pure level of gross matter, you know, there's solids, there's liquids, there's gases. So even you know, on this level, we see a spectrum of experience. And I think then, you know, then you move into the realm of pure energy, and then from pure energy, what into pure intuition or pure thought, pure love. Mm. You know, that you know, that the purest spirit is not alien to the densest matter. They're just, you know, they're just two ends on the spectrum. And so one of the things that you know, and I'll speak out of the Christian tradition, because I think the Christian tradition has made some pretty egregious mistakes here. You know, Jesus was very much a person of the earth. He, most of his teaching stories of the parables, they involve vineyards, they involve sowing. You know, there's just this, you know, his biggest miracle involved feeding thousands of people, you know, very much a creature of the earth. He healed little girls, and then he would say, let's make sure she gets something to eat. Mm. You know, the tenderness of that kind of, you know, he performs a miracle and then he's worried about dinner. You know, I mean, that's just how down to earth he was. And so, and this is why, you know, whatever you may believe about the resurrection, but that, the resurrection matters because it shows that the renewal of life is embodied. Mm. It wasn't just he became a spirit that just whisked off into nature, but that he brought his renewed life right back into the body, and into, you know, having Thomas touch the wound in his side. You know, it was that visceral. So you know, and the Jewish tradition in general is much more kind of nature-centric or nature-friendly than the Greeks. And see, and this is what happened, was that Christianity got filtered through Greek philosophy, Greek culture. The New Testament is almost entirely written in Greek. You know, it's just tiny little bits in the Aramaic, which of course was Jesus's language. And so so you have, you know, God bless the Greeks, but they gave us that more dualistic mind, and that just became filtered through Christianity, and we're still struggling with that dualism to this day. And so this idea that somehow spirit is good and therefore matter is bad, mm-hmm. has just became a you know, a terrible kind of subconscious principle that has just, you know, really caused so much damage. And I think that's why to this day, you know, even the way Christians read Genesis 1, you know, that we are given dominion, mm-hmm. dominion over nature. What is interesting is that the word dominion, you know, so it's what we get the word lord from. So we're given lordship over. Mm. But if you really go back to the etymology, dominion is related to
stewardship, right?
Yeah, it's related to the house, domus, mm-hmm. domicile, domestic.
Yeah.
And so to be given dominion is you are to care for it the way a father cares for his family, mm-hmm. or a mother cares for her family, our job is to run the household. So yes, the concept of stewardship is a beautiful, beautiful image there. that got lost. It got lost through those dualistic filters. And so now, you know, we have a whole culture that thinks nature is just an exploitable resource. And we've seen the horrors, whether it's acid rain, global warming, climate change, you know, nuclear waste that nobody knows what to do with, you know, burgeoning landfills, the throwaway culture. It's just, you know, I mean, every time I take a bag of trash out to the street, I think about, you know, my wife and I are just two people, and there are millions and millions and millions, hundreds of millions of Americans doing this every week. Mm. That has to go somewhere, you know, and it's just, we're not being good stewards. We're not loving our own embodiment, our own nature. And so it is, it's absolutely a spiritual crisis. You know, that if we want to do the kind of hard political choices that need to be made, I mean, we're going to run out of oil with or without the political commitment to renewable mm-hmm. energy. Mm-hmm. And the question is how hard a landing is it going to be? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the fact that we have so many people in positions of power who refuse to just have the conversation. I find it just absolutely devastating. And again, it's an outward manifestation of that deep interior dualism. So yeah, you know, you asked me how I think, you know, my exploration of nature-based spirituality, for lack of a better word, pagan spirituality. Mm. But of course, what I began to realize was that, you know, paganism is just indigenous European spirituality, but there's indigenous spiritualities all over the world, yeah. You know, and, you know, I just had the incredible good fortune to spend a month in Hawaii and talking to, you know, people, you know, native Hawaiians mm-hmm. and to hear them talk about their spirituality. It's almost like you and me talking about our different paths, and we see so much similarity to take, you know, kind of Celtic wisdom and indigenous Hawaiian wisdom or indigenous Native American wisdom, you know, and that the parallels are so, so strong. And it's all built on kinship. It's all built mm-hmm. on relationship. Yeah. That nature is not a resource to be exploited. Nature is something that we are invited to be in relationship with, which means nature has a voice. And we have to listen for that voice. We have to hear what nature has to say. And when, you know, what is global warming, but Mother Earth has a fever, you know, mm-hmm. she is speaking to us. You know, we have to learn how to listen and how to hear that. Mm. So
thank you.
So yeah. Thank you for inviting me to reflect on that, because I think it's something.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody gets a pass here. This belongs to mm-hmm. all of us. And you know, yeah. and the healing of Mother Earth, because that's what we are doing. You know, this is triage. It's not about just protecting Mother Earth. It's about healing Mother Earth at this point. We have done so much damage. Yeah. But that is going to require not just the resolve of one political party. It's going to require a spiritual revolution that happens across the planet. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm thinking, yeah, this topic in particular, among many others, but it's not, at this point, it's no longer an elephant in the room, but it's like a dinosaur in the room, and more than one as well. And as we are talking nature as a mother, and I'm thinking if we as children, if a child doesn't have a functional, healthy relationship with the mother, what will be the result of that, right? So the need of us to really reclaim and redeem our relationship with nature, and again, part of it integrating our feminine side. And I really appreciated that you mentioned, especially this idea of starting with non-duality and connecting non-duality with relationship, because in our tradition, that's our understanding also of non-duality, not necessarily that everything ultimately becomes one in every sense of the term, and we lose our individuality, because there are some monistic schools that may think like that at the end of the day, there is an absolute merging and there's no more individuality and therefore no more relationship. But for us, non-duality is we all share a common center, a common root. We are all inseparable, basically interconnected from one another. We are all family, as we were saying before. We are all brothers and sisters and relatives. So non-duality is the foundation for relationship, right? Like,
yes.
We are
yes.
different from each other, but we share so much in common as a foundation that that in itself is the foundation for relationship. Not like I like to say, non-duality is the ship in relationship, so to say, right?
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes. Thank you for your thoughts, and especially your notion of spectrum versus dichotomy. I really appreciated how, in few words, you crafted that. And all of this for me is very connected to another crucial part of your journey, speaking about non-duality, relationship, and which is your connection with contemplative Christianity and contemplative spirituality in general. And of course, many people hear contemplation and they may think about so many things and define the word in so many ways. I really like the idea of contemplation literally in its etymology, that is contemplum, which is inside the temple, like not literally like becoming a church goer, so to say. And if you miss Sunday mass, you are going to hell or whatever, but realizing the temple is everywhere, right? So you are in the temple versus profane, which actually means outside of the temple. So yeah, I'm curious, how do you personally define contemplation? And of course, how you live contemplation based on how you define contemplation. Is contemplation for you primarily silence, attention, love, all of that, something else?
Yes, the answer is all of the above. Again, after my spiritual awakening and then reading Evelyn Underhill and, you know, beginning to work with a spiritual director, discovering other voices like Thomas Merton, you know, and the historical figures like Julian of Norwich, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Ignatius of Loyola, so forth and so on. Clearly, you know, I wanted to live a mystical life. I had a great teacher one time. His name was Kenneth Leach. And Ken said to me, when we were talking about, I was working on my book, The Big Book of Christian Mysticism. And Ken said, now, Carl, don't call yourself a mystic. And I was like, oh, he's like, no, it's like calling yourself a saint. He's like, that's presumptuous. Mm. He said, be the mystic. Mm. He said, if you're a mystic, somebody else will call you a mystic. Mm. But your job is just to be the mystic. And that has been my guiding light ever since. I mean, this was, you know, probably 20 years ago, we had this conversation or more. So my job is to be a mystic, whether I'm called a mystic or not, is immaterial. It's like our job is to be enlightened, whether we're identified, you know, our job is to be saints. Our job is to be, healers or servants or whatever language you want to use. The language is not what matters. It's the heart that matters. And that right there is a clue into the contemplative. So I'm wanting to live the mystical life. And what I just start running into is that, you know, this language of contemplation, I'm like, well, what is that? You know? So I started reading, especially Thomas Keating. He was, you know, of course, he started the ministry Contemplative Outreach. Mm-hmm. And just this recognition that, you know, and the word contemplation, you mentioned that idea of being within the temple. But it also it carries this connotation of waiting, you know, of being in a position of waiting, a position of listening, a position of deep silence, attentiveness. I think, you know, back in Latin where it comes from, there's almost this idea of waiting for a sign from God, you know, waiting for, it was used in terms of divination, mm-hmm. You know, how is it seeking, you know, the word that is being given to us. So all of that is in the mix. And then, you know, and then what I discovered, you know, just through my research and then working with my spiritual director, is that almost from the beginning, and the pattern was Jesus's 40 days in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. That what people realize that when Jesus went and spent his 40 days in the wilderness, he was silent. So, and then, you know, and then others were silent. You have, you know, in the Bible, be still and know that I am God, for God alone, my soul in silence waits. Mm. In heaven there, before they open the seventh seal, there's silence for half an hour. There is this very subtle teaching, you know, it's kind of blink and you miss it, but very subtle teaching throughout the biblical tradition that silence is an important kind of like nutrient in the spiritual life. And so I came to realize that, you know, why this is why monasteries are silent, why so many monks commit to living a silent life or a mostly silent mm-hmm. life. It's just this sheer recognition that language only takes us so far. Cognition only takes us so far. And that, you know, while language, I do believe language is a gift. I do believe it is meant so that, you know, like you and I are communicating right now, you know, we need this. It is a gift, but it's a limited gift. Mm-hmm. Language does have a dualistic quality to it. Mm. You know, if I say, you know, this is aquamarine, you know, then, you know, this is not aquamarine. This is a bell, you know? And so it's, you know, our language limits, always looks at what is, but also what isn't. The movement into silence, the movement into the heart, is a movement into the place where all the delineations of language falls away, and that we are simply invited into pure presence, the pure presence of love, the pure presence of compassion, the pure presence of wisdom, the pure presence of knowing, but also the pure presence of unknowing. Because again, when you talk about knowing, you can't have knowing without having unknowing. And, mm-hmm. and as you know, in the Christian mystical tradition, unknowing is an important category. Yeah. Light is an important category, but so is darkness. You know, you have the light of the transfiguration and you have the dark night of the soul. So, so this is where language just always fails us. I mean, back to gender, you know, if I call God Father, I am stripping God of his motherhood mm-hmm. or her motherhood. If I call goddess mother or God mother, I'm stripping her or him of the divine masculine. And so we need a place where we bring our spirituality beyond the thrall of language. Mm. And for most of us in our just basic human incarnation, that means moving into some form of silent practice. You know, whether it's a specific practice like mantra work or centering prayer yeah. or the Jesus prayer or something like that, or even something more gentle. I mean, I know people for whom the heart of their spiritual practice is working in the garden, mm-hmm. you know, so it's very embodied. It's very manual, but they get into the garden and they turn the thinking mind off. And it is just pure presence. And out of their love and compassion for the plants that they are planting, they are in the zone, you know.
Going back again, to nature, you know, right? Yeah.
Well, and exactly. I mean, that's why that's such a great example. But you know, to sit on the cushion is to be enlightened. I may not feel enlightened. I may not feel like I've had the same level of insight that, say, the Buddha may have had. But who's to say that I'm not in the process of that level of enlightenment? You know, it's like it's the difference between being awakened by an alarm clock and being awakened by the sunrise. You know, the sudden enlightenment is like the alarm clock. Those are the stories we tell because they're dramatic. St. Paul on the road to Damascus, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, Merton on the street corner. Mm-hmm. These stories are dramatic. But for most of us, I believe it's more like the sunrise, the gentle, gradual sunrise that then caresses us and brings us into our higher level of consciousness. And so we are on this journey without even realizing it. But then the silence helps us to realize it. It helps us to notice it. It helps us to see what is already there.
Thank you.
Dad. So, I could go on and on. I know we're short on time, but
you can go on and on speaking about silence.
And isn't that the paradox?
Yeah, that's the ultimate paradox, right? Reality is paradoxical at the end of the day, right? There is so much to say about silence. And as you say, and at one point we need to enter into silence to really get an experience of what we are talking about.
And this is why I think humor is so important if you do this kind of work.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, it's so funny. My friends all they experience me as a chatterbox, and I really am, but I also have a stable meditation practice because I have to shut it up. And if I don't get on the cushion, the monkey will just keep chattering all day long.
Yeah, but also so I will say that what one says, and I will dare to speak about you in this moment, I feel that what most of the things you are sharing are coming out also from your silence, right? Ideal, right? Ideal, our speaking should come out from our silent moments. I was thinking in terms of the Bhagavad Gita, one of the main texts in our tradition, there the divine is saying, of all secrets, I am silence. So that's an interesting poetic, beautiful way for me to put it. Of all secret things, I am silenced. Like implying, enter into silence and secrets will be revealed. What you cannot normally listen or hear, you will get it. And I connect with what you mentioned about attention. and presence and how much attention is related to even to worship, right? In Christianity, you will say you attend service, right?
Yes.
So it's an implication of attention and as a sacred ritual, as is worship. In our tradition, we'll speak basically the same. Shakshitwa in Sanskrit, which means something like witnesshood. Mm-hmm. Enter into a space where you are witness, where you are being present and receiving it all as much as you can, right? Being the mystic rather than calling you as such, as you were mentioning before, trying to enter that spaciousness.
Thank you. It's to speak out of our silence. I'm reminded of a Quaker proverb. Speak only when your words are an improvement on silence. And to be honest with you, I think if we really took that to heart, we would probably all just be silent. You know, so our words are, hopefully they're an improvement in that they help us to relate. They help us to connect.
Yeah, and not escape from silence, right?
Yes, and I think that is, you know, I was having a conversation, I think last night, a class I was teaching, and somebody asked me, they said, isn't mysticism an escape? And I said, well, it can be. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to acknowledge, you know, there's the whole concept of spiritual bypassing, that, you know, that some people actually use mysticism to abdicate their, you know, their responsibility to life and to compassion and to love. But when mysticism is entered into appropriately, then it impels us to deeper service and to deeper compassion and deeper love. So, you know, mysticism, like anything else, can be abused, unfortunately, but we have to be
reminds
mindful
me
of that.
Some words that once Thomas Merton said to some of the monks at the time at Gethsemane, and he will say strongly in this connection, he will notice that some of them were joining the monastery not for the right reasons, so to say. He will use some disruptive words saying, not all of you are contemplatives. Most of you are introverts.
Right?
And they were like shocked, like, oh, what's going on here? Right? Like inviting them to recalibrate and think, hopefully you are here not escaping again from anything, but embracing silence as a further confrontation, so to say, in the good sense of the term, right? Confrontation as intimacy with reality.
Yeah, and the irony is that I think, speaking as an introvert, that having an introversion, an introverted personality, you know, and this is out of Jung, you know, the Myers-Briggs, the INFP and so forth. But having that personality can be an advantage to doing this work.
Yeah.
But Merton's point is it can also be a shield.
Yeah, which is what you were mentioning. No? Contemplation can be something beautiful, but it can be weaponized or used against yourself.
As a shield to hide behind, where and then it becomes a matter of spiritual arrested development. So it's something we have to be mindful of, which again brings us back to the importance of community, whether it's the one-on-one, like the spiritual director or the guru, or the larger community, the monastery, the sangha, the church, the ashram. You know, to be in relationship with others can become a safeguard. From the ways that we can create our own illusions. So, you know, it's important work. So.
Of course. Carl, in connection to contemplative life, and you were mentioning also monastic life, if you have some, it's a lay person, but instruction and guidance from monastics, the study and contemplation of scripture, I will say, is crucial across traditions, not only in mystical Christianity. Sure. And I recently watched a conversation in which you were acknowledging the possibility of, on one side, of a multidisciplinary approach to scripture, of course, mainly mystical, but also allowing scholarship, modern scholarship, to inform our study, acknowledging its limits. And you also mentioned the word imaginative, right, in that context, like approaching scripture from an imaginative place, which I really appreciate, especially after having recently read Walter Brueggemann's Prophetic Imagination, which is a beautiful word that I recently discovered. So for me, imaginative reading, of course, speaking about just spiritual bypassing, imaginative reading is not escapism into a fantasy world and using scripture to justify that, but daring to imagine the deepest and broadest possible meaning of scripture that I can grasp at any given moment. that I'm reading it, or that I'm reading it, or that I'm being read by scripture, however you want to take it. And I'm currently conducting a study of one of our main books in our tradition called Srimad Bhagavatam, and I'm trying to encourage this type of reading among the students, like, and maybe as the main type of reading, imaginative reading. So I don't know if you have any thoughts that you'd like to share with us about what do you understand, or what do you imagine by imaginative reading, and how do you approach it yourself?
Well, you know, in the Christian tradition, it comes out of, well, there are several sources, but probably the best known one is St. Ignatius of Loyola, who was also the founder of the Jesuits. So it's very much associated with Jesuit or Ignatian spirituality. But the idea is that, you know, you can pick up, say, the Bible, you know, I mean, again, it doesn't have to be the Bible, but in the Christian tradition, you pick up the Bible and you read a story, let's say a story about Jesus, like Jesus saving the woman from being stoned when she was accused of committing adultery. And what you do is you use your imagination to place yourself in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can imagine that you're just one of the guys standing there with a rock. You can imagine that you're the woman. You can even imagine that you're Jesus. You know, you let your imagination just kind of settle into the story. I mean, we know from just modern psychology that when we imagine something, the body responds as if it's real. You know, it's like, you know, you want to lose weight, imagine yourself physically fit, you know, and at your ideal weight and that kind of, I mean, you still have to, you know, be disciplined with your, you know, your exercise and your eating, but using the imagination it's an important tool for people who are healing from, you know, from cancer or other serious illnesses. So this idea, I think Ignatius was kind of dialed into this 500 years ago, and this idea that, you know, the spirit, God, can use our imagination to create a means by which we encounter. The encounter between the creature and the creator can be facilitated through the imagination. And, you know, as somebody who has done, you know, St. Ignatius's spiritual exercises, and then also I lead other people on the spiritual exercises, I can just attest to how powerful a process it is, that just, you know, using your imagination to pray facilitates an intimate encounter with the divine. And that in turn can facilitate a transformed life. So it really is a powerful process. And it's funny because when you talk about like centering prayer or, you know, that kind of apophatic contemplation, it usually involves surrendering the imagination, just like you surrender all your thoughts.
Mm.
So you have this practice of resting in deep silence, resting in darkness and in unknowing. But then you have this kind of parallel, almost complementary practice of diving into the imagination and you know, using your capacity to recreate in the mind's eye a sensual experience. And in that experience, have a meaningful encounter with Jesus or with the spirit or with one of the saints or whatever.
And again, not as an opposite, right? As you say, but as a complement, which is more like of a non-dual integrative approach to
two different paths up the mountain, exactly, you know, and one path is through the desert and the other path is through the forest, but they both lead to the same summit. And so when I was taught in Ignatian method of spirituality, it really revolutionized my appreciation of spiritual wisdom from all around the world. And I realized that, you know, I mean, like, even mystics who have visions, where do they have visions? They have them in their imagination. And I think it's important. That doesn't mean it's unreal, because we use the word imaginary in our culture to mean something that is unreal. But what I'm talking about, and some students of shamanism have used this word imaginal, and I think it maybe comes out of the Sufi tradition as well, to distinguish from imaginary. Imaginary is make-believe. Imaginary is, you know, Mickey Mouse and Luke Skywalker. Mm. But imaginal is using that same mental function, but to have meaningful, real encounters with the spirit world, you know, and that those encounters then can literally transform us and transform our lives. And so I do think we live in a culture where maybe there's a crisis of imagination.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of it is because, you know, I think we have, and this may be a function of capitalism or empiricism, I'm not sure who the culprit is, but this kind of marginalization of the imaginal. So that, you know, that's Barney the dinosaur with little children. let's use our imagination, boys and girls, which I think is fine. But the problem is then there's this kind of implicit idea that that's just for children. And that when we grow up, we put that away, you know. But every artist, every musician, poet, you know, they wouldn't do what they do if they weren't using their imagination. Every business person who has ever created a new product, it begins in the imagination. And it was William Blake who said, "What is now proved was once only imagined."
And you can only enter the kingdom of God if you become childlike, right?
Yes, and like that is maybe that's one of the points Jesus is trying to make there.
Yeah, and I'm remembering Walter Brueggemann. He will say, as you referred to our present culture, and he said, at the current, again, industrialist productive culture, we are expert almost at implementing anything, but we are almost not incapable of imagining anything. So we can implement anything and everything, but in terms of imagination, almost nothing. So imagination comes before implementation. So we cannot conceive an alternative future, basically, if we don't dive deep into the imaginal world.
Well, and then what we also have to overcome is the pervasive cynicism of our culture that says, you know, if you know, so like imagining a world where everyone has access to healthcare, imagining a world where everyone has access to appropriate nutrition. And immediately what people say is that will never happen. That's not practical, you know, and so that is a failure of the imagination as well. And that we cannot dare to dream possibilities. And I understand, you know, you know, universal healthcare, and I know a lot of countries have tried and it's been a disaster, but other countries have really taken care of their citizenry. We have to be willing to see that, you know, the dream that is given to us, if we're having difficulty manifesting the dream, that doesn't mean the dream is bad. That means we have work to do to clear ourselves to make the manifestation possible. And that restoration of the ability to live in possibility is such an important task for us spiritually in this age. I love to say that mysticism is the art of living in possibility. And it's really because of this, you know, the realm of possibility is the imaginal realm. And for so many people, you know, they have been stripped by our culture has stripped them of their innate capacity for the imaginal. And it's a tragedy, I think. So we have a lot of work to do, you know. So
And I will say that because also being stripped away of that capacity, we are deprived of the experience of awe and wonder also, which is so necessary to keep ourselves basically alive, right? And finding purpose and meaning on a daily basis. Because there is so much place for awe and wonder when we dare to imagine, again, when we dare to dream, like Martin Luther King will say, I have a dream. And then, comes implementation, and it may be hard and it may be super complex, but you allow yourself, you give yourself permission to dream. And then, you enter that realm, and then there is awe and there is wonder and there is purpose and there is meaning. And on the contrary, we have this productive society that is filled with hopelessness and crisis of meaning. So I will tie all the things together, right?
Which, as we know, leads to addiction. It leads to, you know, the numbing of the entertainment culture. And, you know, I love a good movie as much as everybody. Again, it's not about dualism. It's not about entertainment is bad.
Yeah.
But entertainment has, you know, it's just like, I don't know about your tradition, but in my tradition, a glass of wine is perfectly fine. But that is not the same thing as having an alcohol addiction. And we have to have a healthy relationship. You know, it's like people who have an eating addiction. You don't just stop eating. You have to learn a healthier relationship with eating. And it's the same thing. We have to have a healthier relationship with entertainment. We have to have a healthier relationship with pleasure in our culture. You know, we have the Puritan idea that pleasure is bad. And then what have we created? We created a consumer culture where pleasure is all about constant indulgence.
Yeah.
Both of those are distortions.
Yeah, the middle path. Let's bring the middle
path. So
Carl, to gradually wrap up our conversation, I'm thinking, looking in the zeitgeist, in the times we are living, looking at the current spiritual landscape and social dynamics, we see many people feeling somehow disillusioned with special institutional religion, I will say, maybe because of the lack of imagination, right? in terms of how religions are presenting themselves or extend their ideas. But at the same time, there's a deep hunger for, again, meaning, purpose, all this tied with imagination, awe, wonder. So what do you think contemplative traditions might, what role do you think contemplative traditions might play in the spiritual future of humanity, basically, in which ways you feel they could remain relatable, relevant in the zeitgeist we are inhabiting?
Well, the first thing, let me just speak very briefly about institutional religion. I do think that we are either on the verge of or in the midst of another reformation of some sort. I think because it's happening in real time, none of us knows where it's going. The fact, especially younger people, are so done with the old models, you know, the old models of church or, you know, that kind of thing. You know, and I know there are some church people who they blame the young people. They think young people are narcissistic or selfish or whatever. And I think that's so misguided. I think that we have to listen to, you know, Saint Benedict said sometimes the youngest monk has the word of wisdom for the community. And I think you can expand that to society at large. Sometimes the youngest members of society have the most to teach us old timers, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to create a better culture of listening. I think that the institutional church, as it looked when I was growing up, you know, the church with the steeple on the street corner, I think that's going away. I don't know what's going to replace it. I'm not, you know, a lot of Christians are nervous about this. You know, is this the end of Christianity? And I'm like, well, if it's the end of Christianity, it's the end of Christianity, but it's not the end of spirit. It's not the end of Jesus's teachings. I mean, as long as there are books, people will have access to Jesus's teachings. You know, what will emerge? I would love to see a religion where Jesus and Buddha and Krishna, you know, and Muhammad and White Buffalo Calf Woman and Kuan Yin and all these amazing teachers are held, you know, as a council of elders. You know, maybe that's what's going to emerge. I don't know. You know, I think that, you know, we have to be open to being surprised by the spirit, you know, and what, you know, what our society needs and wants. But you know, again, I can only speak to Christianity. You know, you could obviously speak to your tradition, but you know, the current model, the church model, was developed in the agricultural agrarian age. And we are not an agrarian culture now, at least mostly we aren't. I mean, even our farms are run by corporations, which I think is dangerous, but that's where we are right now. But the you know, so we need a new model of how we build community. But we need community. Humans need community. The internet has not made community obsolete. It maybe has changed the way we do community, but we need community, and we need to nurture and cultivate our souls. That's those two things right there are the religious impulse. The question is, what institutional form does it take? And Howard Thurman reminded us 100 years ago. He said mystics and institutional religion do not get along. What was true 100 years ago, I think this is why Jesus was crucified. I think we see this again and again and again, that the mystics are always the outsiders. Back to your comment, they are maybe right on the edge on the inside, but they also can step to be just on the outside. And sometimes they get crucified. Sometimes they get burned at the stake. Sometimes they get swallowed in and made doctors of the church. I mean, there's these different things. But the reality is, you know, I agree with Howard Thurman that the mystical impulse and the institutional impulse will always be somewhat at odds. And the question is, again, not to turn that into another dualism, where mysticism is good, but to recognize that mysticism will be essential to reforming the institution. And that's the point I think Thurman is trying to make, and the point that I think all of us have to take to heart, and that those of us who are confident that we've been called into a contemplative spirituality, you know, even if we want nothing to do with the institution, and I understand that, but to try to recognize that we have to embody our spirituality in service of community, and whether that's institutional religion or whether that's some other venue or context in which that happens. I think that's going to vary from person to person, but that's the work that has to be done. So it's like to be faithful to the process and not worry about the outcome. I think that's where we need to be right now. But back to Cynthia Brazero, maybe we should wrap up with her comment that contemplation and mysticism, I really do believe, are our best hope to blunt the impulse towards violence, that kind of unthinking impulse towards violence that we see in America today. And that we certainly saw in 9/11, and that we, you know, that erupted in Nazism, that erupted in other forms of fascism, that erupted in the violence of, you know, of the gulags, yeah. And, you know, and totalitarian communism. There is, you know, I think it was Richard Rohr, who said, if you do not transform your pain, you will transmit it.
Yeah.
And we have plenty of examples of how that has been the case. And I think, you know, we have to be realistic that there will always be a mess between, you know, human beings that work towards enlightenment and human beings that seem to militate against it. That seems to be part of the nature of human existence. And so we have to learn absolutely not to be discouraged when we see, you know, like some of the violence we've seen in America recently, to not let it to discourage us, to see it as a bell calling us to greater mindfulness. I think it was Booker T. Washington who said, "I refuse to let any man cause me to hate." We could say any man, any person. I refuse to let any person cause me to hate, even somebody who maybe is my political adversary or my religious opponent or whatever. It is. They do not get to cause me to hate.
Makes me think of Etty Hillis.
Okay. Yes. I think
I'm
she
about
had
to do a podcast with an author about her book, and she's so much embodying that principle, right?
Exactly. So this is the thing that we all have to keep reminding ourselves and reminding one another, that we are not in this for hatred. We may be in this for righteous anger. We have to stand up against injustice whenever it appears. But that has to be grounded in love and grounded in compassion. If it's not, sooner or later, we just become our own enemies. And so, you know, which has happened. Will probably happen again. And then the spirit being in the resurrection business, she will take the people who are the most lost and work on them for transformation. And that's what again makes all of this worthwhile, is we will always, if we're open to it, we will always see miracles happen. And then the question becomes, how can I be an open enough channel that I can be an agent for those miracles? And then life just becomes beautiful. So
thank you, Carl. As a way of closing, I love to end with if you allow me a few more minutes, we have with a small ludic contemplative exercise that I'll offer you 10 short questions.
Okay.
And for each one, I invite you to reply with a short phrase or even one word related to what that question steers or reveals or awakens in you at this precise moment. Are you up for
Wonderful.
The game?
Please, let's go.
Yeah,
let's
number go. One, what place in nature most easily awakens your sense of the sacred?
Right here.
When you hear the word mystery, what arises in you?
Joy.
What word best describes the deepest movement of prayer?
Silence.
What spiritual virtue feels most needed in our time?
Humility.
What is a word that describes the soul when it feels truly alive?
Play.
Which one, sorry? Play?
Play. P-L-A-Y. Okay, play.
What spiritual practice most helps you return to yourself?
Silence.
Yeah, you can repeat that, no problem. What is something in the world today that quietly gives you hope?
Young people.
What quality makes someone a true spiritual companion?
Passion.
Two more. What quality do you believe the next generation of seekers will most need?
Most need?
Most need, yeah.
humble guidance.
And finally, what is one word that describes the path you are walking right now?
One word.
Niceness can be cruel sometimes, sorry. I give you a few more words. You are very, very good boy and very good, concise person with all the answers you gave. So you can say a few more, no problem.
I think at this point, my path is the path of joy. More than anything else, the path of joy.
So. Well, thank you, Carl, for being a unit of joy for the planet, for enlightening us, all of us, with your words and presence. And may you continue with the good work. We are very honored and pleased to have you had today here in conversation. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.